Hey, good morning, everybody. So as promised, today we're going to begin a small new series of introductions. And these introductions will serve as a platform on three levels. One is to learn the Torah of these introductions, which is very profound and important. Another is to get to know the person who wrote this particular work. And the third level is to put it in a historical context so that we can appreciate what was going on at the time and what the significance is of this person and how it relates to us in terms of especially the development of halacha, which is what the development of Torah in general, what I'm very interested in. So hopefully it'll be of some interest to you. So today's introduction is something that several years ago we alluded to, a piece of it, and it's a work called the Sha'arei Yosher, authored by the great Gaon Rav Shimon Shkop Zatzal. Now, if you look on the front cover, which even someone who is not particularly tech savvy was able to put together, aka me, you'll see four photographs. The two on the ends, on the left and the right side, are two pictures of Reb Shimon. He's known colloquially in the yeshivas as Reb Shimon. On the right, all the way on the right, is the tombstone, the grave marker from his kever in Lithuania. As a Kohen, I've never been to a cemetery. I've been to outside a cemetery, but I've never been to a cemetery, so I was never. This is not the picture that I took. None of these pictures I took, but the middle two pictures, and we'll talk a little bit about these significant personalities. On the left-hand side, you could see that's Reb Shimon on the left with a very, very white beard. Next to him is Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski. Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski was the chief rabbi of Vilna. And he was probably after the death of the Chavetz Chaim in 1933 until his death, just after the beginning of the Second World War. He was the chief rabbinic authority in the world. So he lived in Vilna, but his reach was everywhere. On the next little frame is Reb Shimon, which is on the right side, and he's talking to a man with gigantic bushy peis. That's Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz, who is one of the closest disciples of Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik. Now, Rav Baruch Ber is famous because he was the Rosh Yeshiva of a Polish yeshiva called Kamenetz, which was transplanted, and there is a yeshiva in Brooklyn today, and there's also one in Israel called the Kamenetz Yeshiva. So I want to put this in a bigger frame before we get further into the packet. So I have this picture at home, but instead of getting it from home, I got a bigger one from the academy so it would enable us to see this better. So this is... David, can I ask you for a hand here?
Sure.
Okay, go ahead and hold this. This is... Oh, Alan, perfect. So this is a... Now, I don't know if you could see this so well, but I'm going to go through the whole thing here so you could see it a little better. Okay. So this... I have a smaller one of these at home. There is a fellow in Israel. This is now too much background. His name is Rabbi Yaakov Haber. He has an institute, which you see on the bottom here. It's called Torah Lab. So he put this together, and it's a really important work. The reason why it's important is because, at the bottom line, is it demonstrates how almost the entirety of the Torah world is interconnected. So that means that on the bottom, just in terms of, not every time does everybody realize that Lakewood and YU and Brisk, everybody were all in the same camp. Not everybody sees eye to eye on everything, but we should realize that we're all in the same camp. And this is where it starts at, and you'll see how it kind of pieces together the different yeshivas and the different relationships and how Reb Shimon fits into this picture. Because the Vilna Gaon is at the top here. Al, can I slide you back 1 second? He's at the top here. He's living in Vilna at the end of the 18th century, same time as the breakout of Hasidus. And he has a student. His name is Rav Chaim Volozhiner. So Rav Chaim Volozhiner founds what becomes this, as you can see, the most influential of all yeshivas. Rav Chaim Volozhiner was a revolutionary individual. He himself published quite a bit. He's most famous for his work called the Nefesh HaChaim. Now, he has several students. Many of them are not so known, but his son, Reb Itzla Volozhiner, who was also a Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin. And then, if you move down two generations, we're now in the 19th century, they had two very famous rabbinic personalities in the Volozhin Yeshiva. One was Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik. He was known as the Beis Halevi. That was the author of his responsa and also his commentary on the Chumash. The Beis Halevi, Rabbi Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, who later became the rabbi of Brisk. So the whole world of Brisk starts with this man here. On the left side, you have Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, known as the Netziv. He became the last, probably, I don't know, if the most famous Rosh Yeshiva of Elozhin, but one of the most famous Rosh Yeshiva of Elozhin. He closed the Elozhin Yeshiva, I think it was 1883, because of different issues with the Russian government. The Netziv had several sons. He had two wives. He has an older son whose name was Rav Chaim Berlin. So if some of you are familiar with Rav Chaim Berlin, Yeshiva Sir Ben Chaim Berlin, that's in Brooklyn, it's named after the son of the Netziv. The next son that the Netziv had, his name is Rav Meir Berlin, who changed his name to Rav Meir Bar Ilan, a very famous Mizrahi leader in the 20th century, one of the founders, one of the people who was involved in the founding of Yeshivat Keren V'Yavneh. So he had two very prodigious sons. They were a little bit different from each other, but now we'll raise this up just a little bit, and we'll move it in closer so you can see a little bit better. Thank you.
So, are Soloveitchik related to Berlin at any time?
They are, I think, related somehow, but I don't know exactly what the details are. Somehow. Yeah,
they are related.
But I don't know exactly how it is.
Rav Moshe named his son after Berlin.
So after the Netziv. I don't know how, they're somehow interconnected. I don't know if they're related or just they were very close families. Anyway, although there was some dispute about who was going to be the Rosh Yeshiva, whether it was going to be Rav Chaim Soloveitchik who left Volozhin, or ended up being the Netziv. But anyway, if you move further down, the son of Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, Rabbeinu Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, he was the founder of the famous Brisker methodology, the dialectical analysis of Talmudic methodology. So he is right here on the picture. This is Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. His student, as we mentioned before, was Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz. Now, if you look here on the end, a student of Rav Moshe Lacharev, who was a student in Vilna, was Rav Yosef Leib Bloch. So he is going to be...
Tells,
exactly. Tells is going to fit in here, and that's where you have down here Rav Gifter, but there is another connection, because not only was Rav Baruch Ber Leibowitz a student of Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, not only was his son, the famous Reb Yitzchak Zev Halevi Soloveitchik, the Brisker Rav, as well as Reb Moshe Soloveitchik, who was the Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, which is Yeshiva Sarbini Yitzchak Ochanan until he died in 1941. But so too was Reb Shimon Shkop. So Reb Shimon fits in exactly right here, because Reb Shimon was a student of Reb Chaim. He was a student in Volozhin, so he was a student also of the Netziv, who was right here. And he was hired by Reb Lazer Gordon, the founding Rosh Yeshiva of Telz, to be a Magid Shir in Telz for 18 years. That's Reb Shimon Shkop. Reb Shimon was born in 1860. He became a Rav in several small towns, and then he became a Ram in Yeshiva's Telz for 18 years. In 1928, are you okay with this?
I'm fine.
Okay. That's good. I'm sorry.
No.
Behind the scenes, literally. In 1928, Reb Shimon came to America at the behest of the Chavetz Chaim and Reb Chaim Ozer to fundraise for the yeshivas in Europe, which was not so uncommon. Reb Elchanan Wasserman was also he took a trip to America. He came to Baltimore and other places to fundraise for the yeshivas in Europe, which were very often in dire straits. He comes to America in 1928, and there was a Rosh Yeshiva at YU, at Reitz at the time, whose name was known as the Mechter Eloi. He was a genius from Europe, and he died in 1928. Happens to be that when Reb Shimon was in America, so they asked him to give a guest cheer. He's in America, he's in New York, so he should come to Yeshiva Sarbini Yitzchak Elchanan. Dr. Revels, Zichron Levracha, asked him, come and give a guest cheer. Well, after the Mechter Eloi died, so they prevailed upon him, would you come and would you be one of the Rabbeim, one of the Rosh Yeshiva at Reitz? And he said yes. So he stayed, Reb Shimon stayed in America, and he was a Rosh Yeshiva in YU for 1 year in 1928, until, as Rabbi Rakefet points out, the Chavetz Chaim and Reb Chaim Ozer insisted that he come back to Europe. He had founded a yeshiva in Europe in a Lithuanian town called Grodno. He stayed in this yeshiva in Grodno until 1939, right before the war broke out, when Reb Chaim Ozer said that all the yeshivas, all the boys should come to Vilna. And he did. He came to Vilna. He was in Vilna after the outbreak of the war, and he died shortly thereafter. He died of natural causes. He was born in 1860, died in 1939. Anyway, so Reb Shimon, just to finish the picture, he had a granddaughter who married a very prominent Rosh Yeshiva in America. His name was Rav Zelig Epstein. He founded a yeshiva. It's a yeshiva, very popular yeshiva today in Queens, called Shar HaTorah. It's not on here, but it could be. The yeshiva of Shar HaTorah is called Shar HaTorah. It's now after Rav Zelig passed away a couple of years ago. Rav Kalman Epstein is the Rosh Yeshiva. It's named after Shara Torah. After, it's called Grodno Yeshiva because of the yeshiva that Reb Shimon Shkab had in Lithuania that was wiped out during the war, essentially. So it's kind of like many of the yeshivas. If you look down here on the bottom, let's say, for example, the Telzi Yeshiva. So the Telzi Yeshiva was interrupted by the war. Many of the Rabbeim and the students of Telz were killed during the war, but a handful of them, including Reb Chaim Stein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and a couple of others, they were able to escape, and some of the Rosh Yeshiva who had been in America at the time, like Ramotel Katz and one or two others, they happened to be in America, so they survived. So they transplanted Telz in Cleveland, but really, Telz was a European yeshiva. Like many yeshivas that you see today, they are just transplants of what they were. The Mir yeshiva, now it's not on this chart, because the Mir actually is its own Polish group, but all you see, almost every other yeshiva somehow fits in. So you have Telz, YU, Brisk. Now remember, Brisk makes perfect sense how they fit in here, because Reb Chaim's son, Reb Yitzchak Zev HaLevi Soloveitchik, had two sons, Reb Beryl and Reb David. Reb Beryl passed away. His son is named Reb Avram Yeshua. This is probably TMI, too much information. But Reb Avram Yeshua has a yeshiva, as does Reb Beryl. So some of you have cousins, brothers, grandchildren. Someone just was offered your granddaughter a shidduch from somebody who's learning in Brisk. Well, your first question is, well, which Brisk? Is it Reb David or is it Reb Avram Yeshua? Now, Reb Avram Yeshua is the son of Reb Beryl, who was the son of the Brisk Rav. The Brisk Rav had his own story. What's that?
Third Brisk.
Oh, okay. There's more. Then that's like the individual. Let's say. Then you have Lakewood Yeshivas Chavetz Chaim, which comes from Slabodka, which is more of a discussion. You see, Reb Chaim Ozer Grzesinski is here, who was the famous Posik. And then finally, on the left side here, you have Reb Avram Yitzchak Kohen Cook, who was one of the top Talmidim in Volozhin. Apparently, according to the legend, Rav Cook was the only student in Volozhin that the Netziv allowed to wear tefillin all day. He was also the Purim Rav, who used to make jokes on Purim. But after he left Volozhin, he became a rabbi in a couple of different towns before coming to Yerushalayim, and that's where Merkaz HaRav fits in here. And also, Neri Yisrael is a close relation somehow to, you'll see, because of the Chevron Yeshiva, which is not part of the discussion today, but it all somehow fits together. So even though on paper, sometimes the media, they make it seem like we're very far apart, we see things very differently, but the truth is that we all fit in, almost everybody fits into this family of yeshiva somehow. So Reb Shimon, even though he's not on this picture, should realize that he played an important role in this development, A, because he was one of the people who molded yeshivas Telz in terms of the Telzer style of learning in the 19th century. He is a close confidant to Reb Lazer Gordon. Also having his own yeshiva in Grodno, as well as spending a year at Rietz in 1928. So these are some of the interesting fun facts. We can put this. Thank you very much. Well done. You can put this away for later. Thank you. So now with that background, now we know a little bit about Reb Shimon. We can look at the first page. So this was, I wanted to try to get the earliest copy. So to know for sure, I would have to call our cousin Dr. Lyman, should live and be well, because he probably actually owns the original copy of the Shari Osher, but I try not to bother him for trivial matters like this. Only when it's really serious do I need to call on Reb Schneer, should live and be well. So anyway, so I was able to dig up online. This is the Shar Blot. This is the opening page of a sefer called Shari Yosher. Now, the bottom, you could see it's published in Bialystok. I don't read Cyrillic, let's just say that. It's printed in Poland, it says. The Shari Yosher was published originally in 1928. Then it was republished several times. This is what he calls Chikre Halachos Bedine Hasfekos Ruba V'Chazaka U'Bedine Eidos. What does that mean? It says there are seven gates, seven sections of explorations, chikre halachos, explorations of halacha, bedine hasfekos, regarding to questions of suffek, of doubt, ruba, when you have a rove, v'chazaka, and pre-existing, let's say, established ownership, and bedine edus. So what Reb Shimon does here in this book, which I've only read a small fraction because it's beyond my capability of understanding, he deals with incredibly complex halachic sugyas in questions of how to understand, to break down conceptually, matters of uncertainty.
when you deal with a question in the Talmud, a halachic query, and you're trying to ascertain how to put values on different sides of an argument. So the classic case is, for example, there is a principle that's called hamotzi mechavero olav haraya, that someone who takes something from someone else's property, the burden of proof is on them to certify that it's in fact theirs. So imagine if I came into your house and there was a nice vase sitting on the table. I walked into your house and I walked out with it. So you would say hamotzi mechaver olav haraya. It's in your house, so it's probably. Maybe if it says Geller on it, so that's even a bigger raya that it's yours. Let's say it doesn't say Geller on it. I just come into your house. People see me coming into your house, so it's already unusual. You are the muhzak, meaning you are the previous. It's apparently you're the owner. So then I'm going to claim. What are you talking about? It's not your vase. I saw last night that Dr. Geller, he came into my house. He swiped the vase and he gave it to his mother as a gift. So it would be on, the burden of proof is on me. I'm not saying that happened. I'm saying maybe it happened. The burden of proof is on me to demonstrate that it's really mine and you took it from me. How do you know? Who says my claim is stronger than Mrs. Geller's claim? The answer is because it was in her house and nobody knows otherwise. So she's called the muhzak. She has the pre-existing claim to this object. So if I want to say, oh, I want to give a whole chad gadya, someone stole it from me and then they returned it, so I got to prove it. I can't come into her house and take something of hers because she is the muhzak. So that's one example of a muhzak. But here you have, this is example, a very, very basic, like the most elementary example of a case in the Gemara, which is what you call mamon hamuto besafik, money that is surrounded by doubt. I don't know. You know, you're an onlooker. You don't know who's is. Maybe I'm taking it back. It's mine. Maybe I'm a thief. I don't know. How are you supposed to know? So it's mamon hamuto besafik. So the Gemara has lots and lots of rules how to ascertain who is the rightful owner of this property. How do you go about figuring that out?
Did you know there was internet in 1928?
Right. Yes, that's HebrewBooks.org. Thank God for them. So Rav Shimon talks about in this work a lot of different, very complex permutations of what you do in cases of suffix. That's the content. But the introduction is a very different style. It's a machshava introduction. So I encourage you to turn the page. Now this version is a, I don't know when this was published, I should have checked. It's very recent because the version that I used to use was much older. It was very difficult to read. But this is actually a very nice print, and that's why I used it, because it's definitely a lot easier. So he calls the book Shari Yosher, because if you go to page 6, he describes how his father's name was Yitzchak Shmuel, and his mother's name was Rachel. So you take the first letters of his parents' first names, which is Yitzchak, Yud, Shmuel, and Reish for Rachel. So that's how he spells Yosher. Yosher is spelled Chaser with no Vav. Because you wonder, why is it spelled Shari Yosher without a Vav? The answer is because it's spelled Chaser to memorialize his parents, whose names were Yitzchak, Shmuel, and Rachel. This is not the first time in Talmudic responsa or commentary literature. Some are familiar. I was actually discussing with Nechama last week that there was one of the most famous 18th century responsa is authored by Rav Yecheskel Landau of Prague. It is known colloquially as the Noda B'Yehuda. So the Noda B'Yehuda wrote massive responsa, but he wrote a commentary on what we're learning in the Gemara now. In the Kolol, we're learning Brachos in the morning. He wrote a commentary on Brachos called it Tzion L'Nefesh Chaya, Tzlach. It's called it Tzlach because that's the acronym. Well, why is it called Tzlach? Why is it called Tzion L'Nefesh Chaya? Because his mother's name was Chaya. And after she died, he named his sefer that he wrote his commentary on Shas. He named it after his mother. So that's one of many. So very often you'll find rabbinic literature. You'll find hints to the parents or spouses or children, different references that you find in rabbinic literature. So it's called Shaarei Yosher. The gates, literally it means the gates of righteousness. Yosher, from the Lashon of Yashrus. Upright, but Yosher is really a tribute to his parents. Okay, so let's go to the first page where Reb Shimon describes to us what he thinks this is like the most important thing in life. So I put little numbers there so you can follow a little bit easier. Where I'm now, let's say I'm on line number 6. Let's start with line number 6. Hinei b'medrash. Well, the first word on line. Uladaiti, in my mind. Kol inyan ze, this entire thing, meaning the whole point of the world, we'll see in a second what that means. Nechlal b'mitzvah Hashem shel kedoshim to you. Everything that we're going to achieve, the reason we wake up in the morning, what we're going to put out for ourselves in our life, is predicated on these two words. The Torah tells us, kedoshim to you, we should be holy. So says the Medrash. Dehinei b'medrash, and thanks to this edition, which says it's from Vayikra, it's a Medrash in the beginning of Parshas Kedoshim. Amur, b'medrash amur al mikra zeh. Yachol kamoni, in the quotes, Hashem says, maybe you could be holy like me. Talmud lomar, therefore the Pasuk says, ki kadosh ani, because I am holy. Kedushasi, my holiness, lamaila mi kedushaschem. So, says the Medrash, the Pasuk says, in the first Pasuk in Parashas Kedoshim, kedoshim to you, ki kadosh ani. So the way that the Medrash breaks this down, it says, you should be holy. Maybe we think we should be holy like the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. No, not quite. Not exactly. Why? Kedushasi lamaila mi kedushaschem. Ki kadosh ani, don't think that you're going to be exact like me. I'm going to be different than you. So he says, I don't really understand. What does that mean? What does the Medrash think? That we should be holy like God. So he gives you, what do you think, if someone were to stop you, or wake you up at 4 in the morning, ask you, what is the definition of the word Kedusha? So what would you say that it means? Holiness. Well, what does holiness mean? Explain that to a 4th grader, right? It's not so easy. So he tells you the first explanation, which is the Ramban, and Rashi. Ubiyasod mitzvah zu shel Kedusha isa b'toras kohanim. It says in Toras kohanim, Kedoshim to you, prushim to you. You should separate yourself. Take a step back. The Haramban zal bepirujo ala Torah, and this is in a very important Ramban, where the Ramban describes Herich Levayer. I'm on line number 6, 7, 8, 9. Ha'omer b'mitzvah zu shehu lehisrachik min ho'hanos v'ta'anugim yaseirim af al pi she'maisim she'en rasurim lanu. We should stay away from excessive indulgence. Ubetziur mavlit uma omer she'ef shalom adam lios novel brishus haTorah. He says a person could be vulgar within the confines of the Torah. A person could learn all the 4 sections of Shulchan Aruch and still lead a totally vulgar lifestyle. They could speak in a vulgar manner. They could eat in a vulgar manner. They could be a disgusting person. They didn't violate one small sif in the Shulchan Aruch. He says that's what Ramban is telling you. Kedoshim to you is a catch-all. That's the mitzvah. Ulafize avalpize, says Reb Shimon, lechura divrei hamedrash einam muvanim. On line 13. The words of the medrash don't make any sense. Eich shayach beinyan precious lehistamos lakadosh baruch hu. How is it possible that when it comes to being ascetic, we're going to be like God? That the Torah has to tell us, don't think you're going to be exactly like me. As it says, Shari Omar Yochel Kamoni Talmud Lomar Ki Kadoshani Kedushasi Lamala Mikedushaschem. It says, what are you talking about? The Almighty is totally spiritual. So how did you ever think, maybe we're going to be totally spiritual and ascetic like God? No, that's not the goal. We're not supposed to be as ascetic as God. That's like in the Gemara, there's a thing called a Havamina. Havamina means what I would have thought. Nobody would have ever thought that. That shouldn't have ever entered the equation. We're not spiritual like God. We're physical. We have a spiritual dimension. That's who we are at our core. But you can't say that the Medrash ever thought we're going to be spiritual like God. That's ridiculous, says Reb Shimon. So how could that be what the word Kedusha means? It's outrageous. He says, no way. And then he says, Ubiyoser kasha. It's more difficult. Mashamasik kedushasi lamailam kedushaschem. That it says, concluding that my sanctity is higher than yours. Demuvanze alenu lahavin de be'emes yishdimion ba'kedusha shem dorish meitonu lekedushasi yizbarach. It says, you learn something else from this. It's saying, says the Medrash, don't think your kedusha is like mine. Why? Mine's bigger than yours. Mine's higher than yours. So would you have said that my Kedusha, in relation to God, his is big and I'm small? Would you have said that's the manner of equation? Probably not. It's not a function of kamus. It's not an issue of quantity. It's a it's ridiculous. It's not in the same realm. We don't know even what God means when you say God. You know, we can't get our head around. We're mortal human beings. So you're going to say that the Hamid of the Medrash is wild, he says, but the conclusion of the Medrash is also very odd. You would have said the Medrash should have concluded, no, there's no comparison living or dead. No, apparently there is a comparison. He says, what are you talking about? That doesn't make sense. V'im nomar, and if we say, I'm on line 16, de'ikar muvan ha-kedusha, that the main central definition of kedusha, Shashem dorish me'itanu b'mitzvah zu, that Hashem asks of us in this mitzvah, shal kedoshim tiu lehisrachik min hamosaros, to separate ourselves from excesses, kedusha zu eina misyacheses kla la Hashem yizbarach. And the third question, he says, it's impossible to speak of God separating himself from excesses. That terminology doesn't even compute. So to say that the primary definition of Kedusha is separating from excess and attributing that to God obviously doesn't make any sense either. So Reb Shimon has a breakthrough, revolutionary translation of the word Kedusha. So he says, Lachain, Nira Lani is Daiti, it seems to me, and that is a classic rabbinic way of humbly suggesting an opinion. Sheba mitzvah zu, in this commandment, Kol Yesod Vishoresh Megomas Tachlis Chayenu, is included, and this is big talk, the entire foundation and the root of the purpose and the telos of our lives. Sheyu Kol Avodasenu Va'amalenu Tamit Mugdashim L'Shoresh L'Tovas Haklal. Every single thing that we do should be dedicated and devoted for the benefit of the collective, the community. Shalom nishtamesh bishum maisa utenua. We should never use anything. We should never do any action or benefit. V'tainug shelo yiye beze eze inyan letovas zulasenu. We should never do anything that doesn't benefit somebody else. V'kamuvan, v'kol b'chol hakedushos, shu hisyachdus l'matara nechbada, and all sanctities, everything that has a kedusha element should certainly be for this purpose. And he explains, everything that we do should be for the purpose of others. How so? Because, if you think about it, when Hashem created the world, he did nothing for himself. Everything was a purely altruistic motive, which even that we don't really understand, why Hashem created the world. Some commentators say it was Laman Tuvo, so that he could give to creations. Others say it's Laman Ritzono, because that's what he wanted. We don't really understand. But the idea is, God doesn't need us. That's a very important principle in Judaism. When we daven, when we shake the lulav, when we light Shabbos candles, it's not because he's needing us. He gives us opportunities to bring spirituality into our lives. He doesn't need us. So why did he create the world? It's a purely altruistic motive. So Reb Shimon says, if that's the definition of Kedusha, then I can understand. Because the Havamina is, Yochol Kamoni. Maybe, in a certain sense, even if we're physical, we could also do for other people. We can also be oriented toward altruism, just like the master of the universe. Says the Medrash, Yochol Kamoni, not exactly. Kedushasi l'mayla mekedushaschem. My capacity for giving, God says, is far and away is greater than yours. But, now we can understand, it's different perhaps only, and I say this obviously understanding that we don't really understand God, it's only different quantitatively. Because the concept of giving is shaykh to us, just like it's shaykh to him, kiviyachol. God gives and we give. Obviously, it's not. We don't know what that means, but in principle, we've now transformed the idea of Kedusha into something that has to do with something that we can share with the Almighty. Oh. So now, the question though is, well, how do you talk about this if that's not actually true? Let's say you have a jug of water and you're walking in the desert and the two people and you have only enough for one person. So what do you say? Do you split the jug and both of you die? Do you give the whole jug to the other person? Or do you drink the jug for yourself? It's your jug. So Rabbi Akiva, he taught us the principle that Chayecha Kodmim. You go first. We don't accept the minority opinion. That opinion is rejected. It says share the canteen. So which is it? So Shimon has an awesome way to look at this. Because he says, obviously, every human being has this self-interest at their core. Self-preservation, that's part of we're hardwired. But he points out, that doesn't mean that's to the exclusion of caring about others, even all the time. And he says the following. So take a look, skip ahead to the next page. On page 2, bottom line 31. So, explains Reb Shimon that obviously we have a measure of self-interest. There's no question. On the other hand, parenthetically, the part that we skipped here points out that when we are so self-interested only in ourselves, all the evils in the world come from that. Self-centeredness and selfishness is the root of all conflict. I'm waiting. I expected. I thought. I wanted. I needed. That's the root of everything. So how do you resolve the Torah saying Chayecha Kodmim with this idea that we're saying that we should be as altruistic as possible? So he says the following awesome suggestion. So look at 31. It says, Zgulazu, you know what it is? She is barer v'yis ameitz esel ha'adam. A person, it should become clear and truthful to them. Echuso shel ho'ani shelo. The quality of the I. When I say I, what does it mean? Ki bezeh yumdad kol ha'adam lefi madrigaso. That's how you measure a person. You want to know how you measure a person truly, says Reb Shimon? How do they define themselves when they say I? He says, ha'ish hagas v'hashafel, the person who's low and crass, kol anishalo mitzumtzam rak b'chomro Vigufo. The I that drives him is his physical being. So whatever gives him physical benefit and physical pleasure, that's all he cares about. Higher than that, Misha Lamaila Mimenu, above that, Misha Margish Sha'anishalo Murkav Miguf Venefesh. Somebody who's more noble knows that defining themselves is something that's a spiritual component. Lamaila Mizeh, above this, Mishemachnis Lahaani Shalo Bene Beso Umishpachto. A person who is a more spiritually sensitive person, a more noble person, defines themselves in terms of their family also. Their children, their family members, the people who are close to them, whatever circle it is. So when they see, you know, the Gemara has a principle. Bakol makanim chutz me'av b'no v'drav v'talmido. When a person sees, let's say, their child succeeding, maybe beyond where they succeeded. So a parent who sees that in their child, are they jealous? Do they feel a sense of enmity? No, that would be a pathology if a person felt that way. Parents are so excited when they see that their children do well, even if they go well beyond their parents. Why? Because the parents define themselves. They don't see it as, oh, I'm competing with that strange person. The parents only, they're invested in the children because they see them as a part of themselves. The ani of the parents includes their children. So they see that as their own accomplishment. That's why the Gemara also includes Rav v'Talmido, because a person who is a really proper teacher understands that when their student succeeds, it's an expression of them. The teachers who unfortunately are paranoid about their students succeeding above them, those are not very noble teachers. Those are not the high-level teachers. Those are not the teachers that when you think back, if you ever had a Rebbe or a professor in college or a Mohr or someone, those teachers were excited when they saw us succeed. And some of them we remember for many, many years later, maybe even decades. Because they define themselves, they see their success as a teacher in the success of their students. Because they define their ani, including the students. So he says even further, V'ha'ish ha'holech al-pidarki ha'torah, a person who follows the path of Torah, ha'ani shelo kolel eskol am Yisrael. This is a high level. When they say ani, it means all of Klal Yisrael. And my third son, our third son, his name is Aryeh Mordechai. His name is Aryeh. He's named after the great tzaddik Rabbi Aryeh Levine. So if you want to think of an image of a person who defined ani of Kol Am Yisrael, that would be Rabbi Aryeh Levine. You know, first it's B'nai Beso. So he once went, the story is told, he went to the doctor and he said, my wife's foot is hurting us. But then they tell a story. Simcha Raz tells another story that he was on the bus. I think at that time, I think it was Latrun, which was a prison for a period of time. So he was taking a bus to Latrun because he was the Rafa Asirim. So he describes how the bus driver is asking, like, who are you going to visit in this prison? He said, I have a son who's there. Because he defined his ani, mamash, all of Am Yisrael. Mamash, that's how he defined his ani. That's an unbelievable high level. But if you understand like Rav Shimon is saying, that's mamash, like kivyochol, to be like the Ribono Shel Olam. Because that is the way, says Rav Shimon, that you resolve the contradiction. Because on the one hand, we're saying that we're supposed to be like God and be totally altruistic, take care of other people. On the other hand, the Gemara is saying, Chayecha Kodmim, you have to drink the water, you have to take care of yourself. Well, those are two mutually exclusive values. Says they're not. They're not mutually exclusive values. Because if you view other people as yourself, so then you can bridge that gap. You know, if I see that my wife is cold, so I'll take off my jacket. I'll give her my jacket. It's not like I'm not competing with myself for my own jacket. That might be because she's from Florida and I'm not, so she's always cold and I'm not. But the principle of the matter is that there's now, obviously, even in that frame, let's say close friends, for example. So close friends also, they're like the equivalent of family. You know? There's going to be a question of at what point, if you only have one cup of water, yes, chayecha kodmim. It's chayecha kodmim. But generally speaking, if you define other people as yourself, the motivation to do for them is totally different. And we think about that with the people who are close to us. We don't view taking care of our close friends as sacrificing of ourselves, really. We do, but we don't. We do it lovingly, we do it willingly. You know, those of us who have the privilege of paying tuition, so we take care of that because, you know, we think that's important. That's something we're happy to do. It's not like I'm doing something for somebody else. Says Jim, that's how you dress, but now it's not done. It's not done just to think about all the Jews. Says Rav Shimon. He says even weiter, va'od yesh bezeh milos shel ha'ish hasholim. Not just the person who thinks about all Jews. Says Rav Shimon, writing in Grodno, roy lahashrish benafsho lahargish, he should imbue within his soul to feel shekol ha'olamos kulam hu ha'ani shelo. All of the totality of the universe and all the universes are just a part of ani.
What about a situation a father and son are together, they have one jug of water. Who gets it?
So the din is, it's a difficult question. Strictly speaking, the din is that the person who has the water drinks the water. But there were instances, Rahman al-Islam, we should never know from such things, where in the Shoah there were cases like this, and many great Rabbanim ruled from their heart, allowing parents to forgo things for their children. It's a very high level. It's a very, very high level. But there are not just, I think, more than just one or two. Many, many instances where the din of Chayecha Kodmin was put into a greater equation like that difficult one in those circumstances. It came to different kind of cases, as you can imagine, Rahman al-Islam. But you're right. Strictly speaking, Chayecha Kodmin applies to you. The Gemara has an example when it comes to learning Torah. If a person could learn or the son could learn, so the Gemara says, well, depends. Who, in the case of learning, who do you think is going to be more successful at learning versus who is obligated? It's the Gemara in Kiddushin where it talks about parent-child responsibilities, right? The Gemara says parents is responsible to teach a child to swim and teach the child to trade and educate them, etc., teach them Torah, all those things. So in that discussion, there is a question. What if the parents never learn Torah? So who comes first? So the Gemara has a discussion. It might depend on, in the case of learning, which one of them you think might be more successful. In that case, it could be that the parent would say, instead of spending the yeshiva tuition for themselves, they should spend it for their child. But it's not black and white. It's not black and white.
What about a situation for heart transplant? Apparently, according to university rules, it's not dependent on the merit of the patient. It depends on their position in a waiting list.
Oh, so this is a very important and very complex question in terms of a general triage. How do you distribute limited resources? So it could be for a heart transplant, it could be for financial assistance, it could be for a lot of different things. And then the question breaks down. Sometimes it depends on who's asking the question. There's a difference between whether a hospital system is asking a question, because they look at it from their standpoint, versus whether it's a parent asking that question. You know, for example, when it comes to Hilchos Tzedakah, right, there are concentric circles of Tzedakah. The first line of defense is family first. Mibsarcha al tisalim. So the first line of Tzedakah is family first. Then comes the question, Aniye Ircha, Aniye Eretz Yisrael. So once you're talking about general questions of triage, it's really complicated. It's very complicated because then you have many, many factors. But Reb Shimon, I think, is saying, even though you're right, when it comes to practically playing out some of these triage questions, it's very complicated. And there is a difference between the mitzvah of Hatzolas Nefashos and the mitzvah of tzedakah, and the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So those are not, they won't always use the same litmus test to determine who gets first. But the principle of the matter is that we should see those people in terms of ourselves. When I see a person in the hospital, when I see a person who's greeting them, you know, who works behind the counter at Dunkin' Donuts, I should think, how would I want to be treated if I was working behind the counter at Dunkin' Donuts this morning and somebody walked in the door? Because I have to define them as ani. So the same way that I would want somebody to treat me if I was in that station, so I should treat them that way. And it comes out, he says, even further, so what ends up happening is if you define yourself in this very, very global way, you then achieve actually another benefit, which is a great deal of humility. Because where does arrogance come from? Arrogance comes from defining myself as I'm the only one that matters right now. The world was born on my birthday, and I have a certain set of needs and expectations, so I'm waiting for them. You know, I'm waiting downstairs in the car for her to come down. She's late. She's straightening, she's ironing. I don't know what's going on over there, but I've had this experience when we were dating, sitting in the car downstairs in the city, hoping I'm not going to get a ticket. So so if I define ani as just me, so that's the whole extent of my ani, so of course I'm going to get mad. But that's a very self-absorbed, that's a very arrogant way of looking at the world. But if you see the ani as a bigger picture, so then even the cop who's coming to do his job to send me out of there, So he also has a job. There's a reason that he's doing his thing, and maybe I would do the same thing that he would. So it's all your perspective. That's why he says, you will see yourself v'hu ba'atzmo, end of line 36. He sees himself v'hu ba'atzmo rak ke'ever katan besoch ha'briya kula. You now see yourself on the bottom of page 2 on line 37. You see yourself just as one small part of a very large creation. V'oz, and then, gam regesh avas atzmo ozer lo leho v'skol am Yisrael v'skol ha'briya kula. The feeling of self-promotion, the feeling of caring for yourself enables you, it facilitates you to care about other people in the whole world. Uladaiti, and therefore he says, Merumas inyan ze b'mamar shal hil olav ha-shalom shahay omer. This is what he thinks is the pshat in the Mishnah, Pirkei Avos, that we're all familiar with, probably. Im ein ani li mili, uchshani la'atzmi mo'ani. What does that mean? Hainu, he says, so it's a totally new interpretation. I don't know if everybody thought about this before. Sheroi l'kol odam lis ametz lidog tamid ba'ar atzmo. You got to worry about yourself. Only worry about yourself. Aval imze yis ametz lahavin sha'ani la'atzmi mo'ani. Meaning, if I define my ani just as atzmi, then what am I? I am a nothing. I'm so pathetic. I have to define myself in terms of everything around me. Shem yitzamtzim es ha'ani shelo b'chug tzar kafi maris ayin oz ani ze mahu hevel hu uka ayin nechshav. It's nothing. Avlam tia hargasha so u'meses. If it be true, sheklolos habriyo hu adam agadol. The great person incorporates within him the whole life, everything of existence. Who gamkein aver ke aver katam gufa gadol az rav venisa erko gamhu. Then you're also a great person. The people who think big, it's because they define those other people in terms of themselves. Doesn't matter who they are. So, we're short on time, so I'll just summarize the rest of the introduction, which then Reb Shimon goes on to explain that if we view ourselves as a small piece of a big world, that's how we define ourselves, so then we realize that, wait a second, there must be something that we have to accomplish. There must be some purpose. We must be here to play some part in all of this. And therefore, he encouraged us to think about what's the significance of our ani, and how we are just a gizbar, a steward of this gift that God gave us, our life, and how do you guide that? How do you inform that life? By learning Torah. And then this is the rest of the introduction, explaining that it's important to learn Torah, but it's not just enough to learn Torah. We have to be immersed in Torah. We have to try really hard to involve what he calls omel and yegia. I don't know how to best translate omel and yegia. Omel means like hard work, assiduousness, and yegia means yegia, like tiring. You got to invest a lot of energy. You have to put yourself really into it. You have to toil to be involved in Torah, because if you take your role seriously, you're going to throw yourself 100% in it. You're going to be in it to win it. So the second half of the introduction, which he goes for the next page and a half, about the next page, is describing the importance of putting yourself into the Torah, and that's how he goes on to explain the difference between the Luchos Rishonos and the Luchos Shnios. That the Luchos Rishonos, how did Moshe Rabbeinu have the audacity to break them? He says, because Moshe Rabbeinu understood that the Jewish people need to learn that they need Psal Lecha. They need to write the Torah. They need to carve it out of a rock. They need to put themselves in it, not just stand around, wait at the bottom of the mountain for somebody to come and bring it down to them. You know, hand them on a... So, that's it. You have to be invested in it. And therefore, Psal Lecha. You have to do it, the Rebbe Shalom says to him. So that's how he touches up. It's a beautiful Dvar Torah, beautiful drasha when it comes around Parshas Kisisa, in terms of what's the difference between the first Luchos and the second Luchos. But so the second half of the introduction is more about learning, but the first half of the introduction, I was introduced to this by my Rebbe and my teacher, Rav Moshe Stav from Keren B'Yavne, stuck with me all these years later, that the ideal person, the ideal human being, is somebody who views ani as including others in these concentric circles, starting with their family and their close friends and their community, and then the Jewish people, Bechlal, and then all of humanity, and that will give us both a sense of caring and how we value things and how we treat other people, and also, derech agav, it'll give us that sense of humility of how we see ourselves as a little piece of a much bigger picture. I think it's a very important idea that's tucked away in the beginning of a very complex halacha sefer. So if you see on the front cover at the end, this is the, so to speak, the end of Rabbi Shimon. This is when he passed away in Mar Cheshvan. In Tuf, it's cut off there, it was 1939. So we would say that this introduction should be an aliyah for his neshama, which is not passed away not so long ago, but hopefully it'll be very instructive for us in thinking about these things. And that's kind of bringing it back to the beginning, how you see how this teaching is so important for us, but also how it fits as somebody who is educated in the modern era. It's so relevant to how we view our life today. So I thank you all for coming, as always. Yeah.